Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly Extra. This is the extended interview with physicist and skeptic Professor Robert Park. He's former chair of physics at the University of Maryland and most noted for his critical commentaries on pseudoscience. His previous best-selling book was called Voodoo Science. In it, he criticized alternative medicine, telepathy, and homeopathy. Professor Park, in your new book, Superstition, The first few chapters are particularly critical of the Templeton Foundation. Now, we've talked about the Templeton Foundation in the Science Podcast before. Tell us what this is and why you have a problem with them.
Well, the Templeton Foundation is a foundation created by Sir John Templeton. Now, with the Sir, you might suspect that John Templeton was British, but in fact, he died about a year ago, but he was raised in Winchester, Kentucky, right in the middle of the Bible Belt of the United States, and I believe his parents were Presbyterian and quite devout, and he grew up equally devout, and his parents emphasized two qualities in particular, and that was an emphasis on frugality and piety. And he learned both lessons so well that when he became a multi-billionaire, as he did because of the emphasis on frugality, and the Templeton Investment Fund, a worldwide investment fund, he did very well, became one of the richest men in the world. And he did two things. He decided that he would create a foundation that sought answers to the great questions of spirituality, and in doing that, he'd also decided that he would move to the Bahamas because of his emphasis on frugality. That spared him paying an income tax in the United States. And so he gave money to charity because of his other quality. And he was knighted by the Queen, and made Sir John Templeton as a result of his many contributions to charities. So an interesting fellow, but he was more interesting than that. Initially, the prize that he gave was for spiritual development or something of the sort, and it was given to people who were like Mother Teresa, who we would all recognize as spiritual figures. But as time went on, he went through some sort of a change. There was a recognition that there was something beyond that, namely science, and he changed the name to Spiritual Discoveries. It became a prize for spiritual discoveries. This was not a small prize. This is the largest prize given for intellectual activity. He decreed in creating this the Templeton Foundation that the prize should always be larger than the Nobel Prize.
Just for publicity's sake.
Because he thought it was more important, he said.
This Templeton Prize is essentially for research that brings science and religion closer together.
Discoveries about religion from the standpoint of science. And so for several years, I think almost 8 years, every year the prize would go to another scientist.
And which is not a bad thing for science, I suppose.
Not a bad thing.
Some of the greatest great scientists have won this prize. Paul Davis, the Australian physicist, for example. And he's a great popularizer of science, a great physicist. And I think that it's interesting that this particular prize seems to be going to physicists and cosmologists, the guys who are doing the big questions. Does that make sense?
It hasn't always gone to the person who made the biggest discoveries. It was much more scientists who, in their work, were kind to religion, if you will. So big discoveries by scientists who were dismissive of religion would not garner that prize.
You're not looking to get onto that shortlist then. Richard Dawkins has famously said that this prize is for scientists to say something nice about religion, and that if he ever was to change his mind, if he ever fancied some money, he could change his mind. He would probably get, you know, a couple of million or whatever. Now, so there it is. There's a prize, $1.5 million for saying something nice about religion. And the Templeton Foundation also gives out grants for research.
Yes, they do.
And especially in areas where there's little public funding. So you can imagine some physicists are thinking, this is a great way of getting money. Now, what's terrible about money going into science like that?
Well, it's not really a bad thing as long as it's honestly done. And in fact, the Templeton Foundation funded a study on whether prayer is beneficial. And the study was made of people who had undergone heart bypass surgery. And did they recover faster if there were a group of expert prayers? I'm not sure exactly what that qualification for that is. But if these people were praying for that person, did they recover better than people who are not prayed for? And they had a huge database. It's an operation that's conducted very frequently. And so there were, I believe, 185,000. So the statistics of the study were marvelous. One doesn't often get that larger database. And so the statistics should have been very reliable. And at the end of the study, what they found was that there was no benefit to be seen. They did not one bit better than the others. In fact, they had a subgroup in which they told them they were being prayed for. Now, these by and large are so-called, these kinds of prayers. The person doesn't know someone is praying for them and certainly doesn't know the person doing the praying. This tries to take the uncertainties out of this of people who are simply feeling better because their loved ones are praying for them. But these are strangers that are praying for them that don't even know them. And so do these prayers help at all? And the result was they didn't seem to help at all, except for one group that were told this they were being prayed for. They did worse.
Was it performance anxiety?
They described it as performance anxiety, yeah. Indeed, quite amusing.
If I'm having an operation and I know someone's praying for me, I don't want to disappoint them by not getting better.
You don't want to disappoint them, I suppose. That's right.
That's probably the way it is. I mean, we're having a laugh about this, but actually, plenty of people believe in the idea of prayer. They believe that they get better from these sorts of things. And you use the Templeton Foundation in your book as a way of talking about the fact that even very clever people can believe this sort of thing. And the people who win these prizes are very clever. What is your problem with belief more generally than that? The Templeton Foundation tries to put it in scientific context, but more generally than that, what's wrong with just blind faith?
Well, a blind faith is, if you will, one of the problems of blind faith is a world that is perpetually at war. And in all of these wars, whether they're caused by that or caused by something else, the people are driven very much by their religious beliefs. And the religious beliefs are exploited by the countries that are at war. So in war, both sides pray for victory. And so if you're on the winning side, your religion must be right. But it doesn't change anybody's mind. And so certainly I would see perpetual war as religion being a contributing factor, if you will, in perpetual warfare. But there are many other problems. The problem is it does away with openness. The greatest contribution of science, far greater than the technological advances that we enjoy, is openness. And governments would do well to emulate science in this. Science is totally open. That's its characteristic. Every new discovery can completely change science can reverse scientific beliefs that we've held for centuries, and sometimes do. So we're open to change. And I think openness is what the world needs most right now. There are no secrets in science. Science does not work well with government secrecy. It has always been a problem. In a dangerous world, you can understand why governments want to keep secrets. But even in an undangerous world, politicians love to have secrets. They decide what to release and what not to release.
This is the exercise of power, surely.
Well, surely.
Yeah. Belief exists for a reason. That it's somehow innate within us that we want to believe things.
Well, that's kind of a frontier right now of research. In neuroscience right now, one of the things that is most interesting is this search for what are our core beliefs. What are we born with? What are our instincts? All animals have instincts, and they also learn. We have instincts, too. But of course, those instincts were developed over hundreds of thousands of years. Well, at least 160,000 for Homo sapiens. And many of our reactions go back far before our ape-like ancestors. So for just Homo sapiens, the modern humans, 160,000 years, and all of civilization is a mere 10,000 years old. So so our instincts, if we have instincts, go back a long way and had many years to develop, and we're not going to change them with a few years of technology, for example. So technology is having no effect on our inner instincts at all. And the scientists studying this break it down into roughly, I think, five different instincts that they can pretty clearly identify. And these are instincts like respect for authority. You can understand why that was important to tribal societies. And also tribal loyalism, group loyalty is a very strong instinct in human beings, as is protection of the weak. And this seems to extend to every human culture. Protection of the weak is built right into us. The strongest of all of these, perhaps, is the reciprocal response, which among Christians is usually referred to as the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And it's a marvelous rule. As a matter of fact, if you look over the Ten Commandments, which Christians generally cite as their reasons for proper behavior, it's a bunch of negatives. The positive is the golden rule and seems to cover all the others.
These things have developed, as you say, over tens of thousands of years and have survived because they've done humans well. The humans have sort of taken over the earth because of their ability to deal with each other in this social way. So what's wrong with having these sorts of very innate beliefs and things now? I mean, is there a tension between what we know about the world now compared to what we did 10,000 years ago? We know, for example, that the sun is the center of the solar system and the earth goes around the sun, which we didn't do 10,000 years ago. Maybe people thought the sun appears and disappears every day, so that's why you need a belief to work out what happens in the meanwhile. But now we know that enough physics to know that's not true. So do we just abandon those beliefs?
Well, I think we ought to open our minds again. What we need is openness. And the problem with the belief system of that sort is always that it's absolute. There is no provision for changing the Bible. We adhere to the Bible, or people adhere to the Bible, as it's written, or at least as it has been translated by Greeks a long, long time ago. And the translators, it turns out, made a lot of changes themselves. So they were infusing their own personal beliefs into it. But nonetheless, we don't go around changing the Bible. So science, on the other hand, is completely open. So you can challenge any scientific beliefs. And if you have the evidence, if you have good evidence, you're going to win. And so science turns over beliefs that have held for all time. And in fact, this is what every scientist seeks to do. The more long-lasting the belief, the more interesting it is, in a way, to find out if this is exactly right. And sometimes they're not.
There's an interesting dichotomy, isn't there, with people who are the target of your anger in books in books like Superstition and your former book Foodie Science, where they might be pseudoscientists themselves. They don't know how to apply the methods of science, yet they respect the scientific method enough to try and make you believe that it's scientific. So for one example of this, for example, is the people now who are selling huge numbers of books and treatments and things about using quantum mechanics to try and explain how the brain works, and saying that consciousness is explained by quantum mechanics, and that if we can understand the world of quantum mechanics, we can understand healing and all sorts of other things. Now, I'm not suggesting here that they're necessarily absolutely wrong, but to me that sounds like a misappropriation of a very complicated idea onto people who maybe don't understand what quantum mechanics is.
Every time I read a book on quantum mechanics or an article on quantum mechanics and run into the word consciousness, I go no further. I know that it's going to be followed by bullshit.
There's a whole movement in there, isn't there? And especially in the States, of people who use quantum mechanics to try and explain why we do what we do, why we believe what we believe.
The uncertainty principle gives them an opening.
That's right.
And in my book on Superstition, what prompted the book was my meeting with two Catholic priests who found me after a tree had fallen on me. And had, in fact, administered the last rites. And we became very close friends. And we talked about these things often. And they were interested in quantum mechanics. These were educated men. They were both faculty members in a Catholic seminary. And they said, well, but there's the probability factor that comes into it. This gives a little opening where God can squeeze in what he wants. And so that quantum mechanics perhaps provides that opening. And I tried to explain that I don't think you can go very far with that one. This is more a measure of the fact that we really can't measure things as accurately as we would like. There's a limit to it. There's a sort of graininess to the universe. And we can't get beyond that graininess. We can't. It's not perfectly smooth.
But why do you think people like that even use science to try and explain what they do? Surely, if they're so contemptuous of it, they would just dismiss it.
Well, perhaps they're fascinated by the fact that there might be something there, and so they keep trying to prove it. Certainly, if you make a discovery of that sort and can prove it, you're going to be one of the world's most famous scientists. So there's always an attraction there to disprove these things.
Well, perhaps the sixth thing on your list of basic human intuition should be proof in that case, because even people who have faith want proof, ultimately, don't they?
Ultimately, we should all want proof, but we don't always ask for it. Or at least we may accept as proof things that really aren't proof at all, like a quotation from the Bible or this sort of thing. Mm. Of course, religion can also do beneficial things, and often does. It's just that there must be other grounds for this, and our instincts seem to provide that. The protection of the weak is one of our instincts, for example. In fact, what started all this was the belief, the understanding, which is increasing, that we know good from bad. And the religious people have always said, well, this is because, in the words of the two Catholic priests that I met and became close friends with, in their words, the Holy Spirit has planted this in our hearts. Well, what the Holy Spirit has planted in our hearts is what Darwin would have called evolution.
Your book, Voodoo Science, was published almost 10 years ago now. And it sort of it laid out a lot of things that that some of us might be familiar with now in terms of the whole, what Ben Goldacre does for us on bad science in terms of dealing with bad statistics and looking at how scientific methodology works, trying to work out what is good science and what isn't. You gave some excellent examples in there, people coming up with perpetual motion machines and all sorts. I just wonder, looking back on that book now, have things changed? Did you think that now people have a greater respect for science or not?
Well, I'm afraid my book didn't help much in that regard, because the certainly with the energy crisis, the ease of pushing ideas of perpetual motion machines and this kind of thing,
people want
just
to hear
as strong
things.
As ever.
People want to hear these things, but it doesn't mean they're true. But I mean, do you hear that? Do you still get letters about perpetual motion machines today? Do people still say to you, I've just invented something that breaks all the laws of thermodynamics, for example?
Over the years, I have discovered about 5 such inventions a year. And I get letters about every one of them. But about 5 a year is sort of standard. There are 5 big claims of perpetual motion each year.
None proved yet.
None proved yet, no.
But in terms of the general sort of appreciation or understanding of science from the lectures you give and people you talk to, do you think that people are more aware of this sort of, as you say, bullshit?
Well, many people seem to be, and many people aren't. This is not something people want to hear. It's much more exciting to live in that kind of a world, and in our day-to-day jobs, it's just kind of nice to have a little excitement coming in the form of miracles, but they don't happen.
One might argue that having beliefs about things like whether there's a God or not, or whether quantum mechanics really explains consciousness, or even the New Age crystals heal you, it's kind of innocent, really, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't really matter as long as you keep it private. You hinted at the idea of war earlier, the idea that different people with different beliefs will go to war. But are there other ways that this is dangerous, that these beliefs aren't just sort of childish things that we can just ignore?
Well, it is certainly dangerous in those cases where people have a serious illness and believe they can cure themselves with a crystal or some other procedure, acupuncture or something else. It has that risk that people don't seek real help when they need it because of their belief in some mysterious type of prayer or something.
What about politics? You have a new president now in the U.S. We'll talk about him in just a second. But George Bush was famously contemptuous of science, or at least he didn't like the idea of scientific evidence informing policy. For 8 years, the U.S. stepped out of things like the global warming debate and in some respects, stem cell science. Do you think that his legacy will have any impact on the way that science is done?
Well, it cut about 8 years out of our progress, but other than that, it certainly it did not help American science and hindered it greatly. But we'll recover. I'm very optimistic right now. When thinking about who should be our leaders, I don't worry about what they know. I worry about who they ask for advice. And so far, the people that Obama has selected, certainly his key advisors on science, are top rate, and I'm very encouraged that we're in for a much better period.
He did actually mention science in his inauguration speech, Obama, and said that he wanted to put science back in its rightful place.
Yes.
And he talks a lot about using evidence for policy. But in terms of his plan, the position of the United States now, one of the most important things that American scientists have to do is convince their leaders to do something about global warming. That's a fantastically complicated issue with lots of emotional elements to it as well. Do you think that change in administration is going to be useful for that sort of thing, that it's about evidence at the end of the day?
Absolutely, no question. But in fact, it brings up what is the issue that has most concerned me in the last few years and in the Bush years. As we look at global warming, there are scientists who dispute the fact that there is global warming. It's not clear how many of those are in the employ of the oil companies. But beside that, there are people that doubt that global warming is real. How do they explain the data? Well, they explain it by saying it's variations in solar radiation that are taking place. Well, there is an easy way to find out. And the easy way to find out is to place a satellite, a solar satellite, at the L1 point. Now, the L1 means the Lagrange 1 point. Lagrange was a great mathematician and worked out the mathematics of these stable points. And you can think of it essentially as a point between Earth and the Sun, where the pull of gravity is equal in both directions. So at that point, you can put a satellite and it remains in its position with respect to the Earth and the Sun without the need to fire any retro rockets. So it's there pretty much permanently. And so in one direction, it sees the Sun and can measure its output. And in the opposite direction, it sees the whole Earth because it's on the sunlit side of the Earth. So it sees the full Earth all the time and can measure the amount of radiation coming back from the Earth. This is the albedo, the reflectivity of, if you will. And the albedo then tells us how much energy is going in and how much is coming back. And that tells us whether the Earth is warming or not. If it's going in and isn't coming back, the Earth is getting hotter. And this is a straightforward measurement. There is no other way really to measure it. We try to measure the albedo with satellites, but the satellite can't see the whole Earth. It sees a tiny fraction. Most people don't realize how close to Earth a satellite is. So the satellites that we use for Earth satellites that we use for observing are much too close to get a good view. They just see a spot. And we try to average these over a great many observations and calculate some measure of the albedo. But to know it accurately and to follow it hour by hour, we have to have a satellite at that L1 point. There's just no other way to do it. And in fact, other countries have offered to launch the satellite for us. It was ready to be launched in 1989. It should have been launched in the Clinton administration, but there was an accident with the shuttle, and it was supposed to be launched from the shuttle, and so the shuttle didn't take off. And by that time, Bush had become president, and Bush canceled the project. So the observatory was already built. We had paid $100 million for it. In days of trying to solve the economic crisis, $100 million doesn't sound like much money, but it's still a lot of money in science. And so $100 million then is what this thing cost. It's sitting in a warehouse in Greenbelt, Maryland, all these years. Now, fortunately, it wasn't destroyed. I feared it would be cannibalized. And you ask, well, why were they so unwilling to launch this? And the answer is it was a favorite project of Al Gore. So the reasons were purely political. For political reasons, it's been locked up in this warehouse, incommunicado, if you will, and we desperately need. It's going to have to be refurbished now. It's going to cost a lot of money and a little more time. But I think one of the first steps of this administration will be to launch. It has an acronym called DISCOVER. And it stands for Deep Space Climate Observatory. So the Deep Space Climate Observatory, I hope and believe, will be one of the first goals of the new administration. It'll have to be refurbished and improved, in fact. We've learned a lot in the 8 years in electronics, and we can make it an even more powerful instrument than it was. There are a lot of things besides just the albedo that it can study for us.
We've talked about belief, how it might have evolved, why it was important for our ancestors, and why perhaps now, as our species grows up, it might be a good thing to abandon, given that we have so much knowledge from science and so much more to learn through scientific methods. But what would you say to the argument that if you do give up all of the sort of imagination and belief, that it kind of makes the world a bit of a grayer place?
Oh, I don't think it makes it any grayer. Oh, I think it makes it far more. It's got to be better to know than not to know. That's not a gray universe. That's a brightly colored universe. And yes, I think that's exactly what we need. And I think we can do it. The first thing we have to do is to understand why religion has had such a hold on us. So this is why the neurological studies that are being done now with very modern instruments, the functional magnetic resonance imaging device, whereas it's been exaggerated somewhat in recent months because it's new. And so all the data is brand new and exciting. And so we've kind of overinterpreted it. But that'll settle down. And this kind of device, learning what's really going on in the brain, can tell us a lot about ourselves and why we hold these instincts. And once we understand it, then the instincts are no longer harmful. So, and many of them, of course, I suppose, are not harmful even now. Fear of being run over by an automobile is not greatly different from being run over by a rhinoceros, I suppose. The opportunity exists now for human beings to begin to understand themselves better. And when they understand themselves better, I think religion will diminish.
Do you see a time when it'll disappear altogether?
Oh, that time is a long way away. But yes, I hope so. But if mankind is to survive, we have to change the way we think before our brains ever get changed by evolution. It's going to take a long time with evolution. And with the world changing so rapidly, it's pretty clear that evolution just can't catch up. And we can't stop and wait for it to catch up, or we won't exist any longer. So we're going to have to understand ourselves better. That's the real message. My psychologist friends would applaud that, I'm sure. But psychology has changed. And when I was a student 100 years or so ago, psychology was considered a soft science. And we physicists sort of looked down on the psychology majors. But all that has changed. Psychology is now the frontier. And it's been made possible by the new instruments that the physicists developed, if you will. But with these instruments, it's a whole new science and a very important one.
Robert, thank you very much. Professor Park's latest book, Superstition, Belief in the Age of Science, is out now. I'm Alok Jha. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. Your thoughts are always welcome. guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.